From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the National Women's Law Center, more than 16 million women are living in poverty, or were in 2016. Nearly 900,000 of them are in Georgia. Why are so many women poor? Well, we're looking at the complex relationship between women and money, beginning with how we got here. George Robb is author of Ladies of the Ticker, Women and Wall Street from the Gilded Age to the Great Depression. He's history professor at William Patterson University. And George, good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us, Diana Pierce. She's director of the Center for Women's Welfare. She's a social work professor at the University of Washington. And Diana, thank you for being with us on this early hour for a West Coaster.
Thank you, too.
Diana, you are the woman who coined the phrase, the feminization of poverty. Now, where did this come from?
Well, it came from a trend towards more and more families in poverty being maintained by women alone. So that was disproportionate. In the early 70s, it was about a quarter of families. It then moved up to about half of families, and it stayed that way ever since. And there's two basic reasons for that. One is that women are disadvantaged in the labor force. There's a wage gap, which has closed, but has stopped closing in the last 15, 18 years.
So let's pick that up. George, you've studied this historically. Now, what are some of the cultural or historic factors that have made women more prone to poverty, both in those cases that she was talking about, labor force and wage gap?
Well, there are historical deep roots for women's economic disadvantages. Most American women couldn't even vote until 1920. They weren't fully citizens. For centuries, women were under the legal guardianship of their husbands. They couldn't sign contracts. They couldn't own property. They had no right to their wages if they earned money. And this only began to change in some states in the 1850s. In other states, not until the 20th century. And the worst case I can think of, I'm sorry to say, is Georgia, where married women didn't have a right to their own wages until 1945.
Hmm. And your book, Ladies of the Ticker, talks about how women played essential roles in areas like banking and the stock market. This is during the late 19th century and early 20th century. Wasn't that considered unladylike?
It was considered very unladylike, and these women were constantly pushing against barriers, of people not wanting to share investment information with them or not wanting to employ them in financial industries. And this idea of separate spheres, that women's proper place was in the home, they needed to be sheltered from the rough and tumble world of money making. So when women tried to do unconventional things like work in banks or make money on the stock market, they were accused of becoming unsexed. That's the term they used 100 years ago, this idea that if they entered the world of work, they would become masculine, they would become aggressive, they would become unlovely, no one would want to marry them. These kinds of ideas. Had strong cultural resonance at the time.
And Diana, this is a critical point. Around that same time, early 20th century, New Deal social programs, including what came to be known as welfare. How did welfare aim to address the particular needs of women?
At the time when women became poor, they ended up having to put their children in orphanages. Many times the jobs that they had were things like live-in maid. They were not allowed to bring their children with them. So if they lost their husband, they could not both work and take care of their children, and there was no child care. So children in orphanages weren't orphans. They were the children of single mothers. So welfare was intended to address that.
And we have some big changes in women's economic prospects during the war. Of course, many women went to work with the absence of men. During World War II, there was this surge. George, did women start below men on the salary scale?
Oh, always, always. And even in some industries that were, or some jobs that were highly feminized, like teaching or clerical work, that was the advantage of hiring women. You didn't have to pay them as much. The idea was they didn't have families to support, which wasn't always true. And many, well into the 20th century, a lot of school districts and a lot of corporations had a marriage bar so that they would only hire single women, and most women are going to get married. And at the point you get married, you have to give up your job.
Hmm.
And this was also an excuse for not promoting women because it's like, oh, they're eventually going to get married and leave, so we won't promote them.
And we see this double standard. Women were making money. Could they, however, apply for loans and housing and other benefits that men returning from the war could?
They could. Banks were very happy to take women's money, to take their deposits, but not to loan them money. So women historically have had much less access to credit, and that, I think, continues to be a problem.
I'm wondering, you know, when did we come up with this stereotype of women only knowing how to shop and to spend money when in so many houses they were the traditional, let's say, managers of the purse?
You know, that's an old stereotype, but you're right to point out there's this disjuncture that, you know, in the Victorian period, women were managing tight household budgets, and some middle-class women had several servants they were hiring and firing, and, you know, their house was like a small little business. And yet the reality was that women knew how to manage money, but the kind of the public image, the cultural images, the propaganda, if you will, was that women were these flighty things that couldn't balance their checkbook and, you know, were spendthrifts and all of that. And so there's definitely this contradiction between the reality and public images.
Right. Diana, this traditional image, women receiving her husband's check each pay period and then managing the money. How about for single women? What were the particular challenges for them?
Well, again, the problem of both working and taking care of your children. So, and now today, the problem is only having one income. And as costs have continued to rise, particularly in the 21st century, having two incomes is necessary in almost everywhere for families to be able to support children.
What is the wage to cost balance with women now in terms of the money that they have to spend?
Well, the costs are going up faster than people's wages. We're finding that everywhere. Using an alternative measure of the cost of living called the self-sufficiency standard, we find that in Georgia as well as Washington, New York, every place, costs are going up faster than people's wages. The costs went up even during the Great Recession when people's wages stagnated or fell or their hours fell. What's happening is that people are shifting to jobs that are lower paying at the same time that costs like rent and food and health care, child care, the basics are going up. They're going up faster than prices in general, and they're going up certainly faster than wages.
Poverty rates continue to rise among women across the country and here in Georgia. And we're talking about some of the roots of female poverty. Diana Pierce is with us. She is the woman who coined the term, the feminization of poverty, and George Robb, author of Ladies of the Ticker. He wrote about some of the women who broke ground as entrepreneurs and investors in the early 20th century. George, that term, feminization of poverty, is still considered controversial. Why?
A lot of people want to deny that those kinds of gaps exist. And I think America has this image of itself where, where we don't have class, or this myth that everyone's middle class. And, you know, rich people want to call themselves middle class, and many working poor people will apply that term to themselves. So this, you know, creates a kind of reality or makes it difficult for people to talk about class barriers.
And Diana, we're talking about gender gap, but what about women of color who've been left behind in the economy?
Of course, racism also plays a part. And for women of color, they're experiencing both sexism and racism in the labor force. And, of course, they face the same costs in terms of housing and child care and that kind of thing as white women. But they face it with lower wages. Consistently lower wages across the board.
We did ask some Atlanta women about their personal experiences.
Some of the reasons for poverty among women would be not having the resources from their family.
I think the most obvious one is the pay discrepancy, the salary discrepancy in the workplace.
I think probably lack of education, original family home life, the growing situation, and employment.
I think it would be the family structures with fathers not standing in the place and taking care of the home and women having to step up.
Those are the voices of Andrea Mulvaney, Esmerit Twell Daberhan, and Sue Seglia. So these are some of the old saws that we've heard a lot about, you know, the family structures, women having to step up. How about in the workforce currently? What are the challenges that women face in the workforce in particular? Who wants to pick that up? George, Diana?
Well, I think one of the things that is true in the workforce is that women are occupationally segregated. As George pointed out, women were brought into the labor force, but concentrated in certain professions like teaching and nursing. But other than those professions, they've been concentrated in low-wage jobs, child care, administrative assistants, what we used to call secretaries, and those kinds of jobs, service sector jobs. And when you concentrate people in a particular occupation, and it's a low-wage occupation, you get locked in, and it becomes difficult to get higher wages. So occupational segregation is a piece of it. But there's also the economic costs of things like sexual harassment. If you're sexually harassed, what most women do is leave the job, and that has economic costs and affects their ability going forward to promote their career and move up in terms of income.
These attitudes, these structures, sound like deeply embedded in our culture and history. So, George, what's the way out? Policy? Is it attitudes? Where do we go from here?
Well, it's a lot of things. I think that, you know, we have a lot of laws in the books right now against sexist hiring and promotion practices and against penalizing women for taking maternity leaves. But those laws aren't any good unless they're enforced. And a lot of women are afraid to complain. They can't afford lawyers. District attorneys and attorneys general have to be willing to prosecute corporations, for example. And I think in today's political climate, there's little pressure from Washington to go after big business. That's one problem right there.
Well, Diana, your center at the University of Washington, this is the project of the Center for Women's Welfare, known as the Self-Sufficiency Standard. Now, what are you doing in this program?
What we're doing is calculating what the basic cost of living is and comparing that, as I did earlier, to wages. So, for example, in New York, it's going up 80% over the decade, and wages have only gone up about 30%. So everywhere you look, you have this gap, this increasing gap. So what we're doing is pointing out what it really costs to meet your basic needs.
Right. And from there, determining what? Way forward?
Looking at ways to, there's basically two ways to get to the self-sufficiency level. One is to increase wages, raising the minimum wage, more labor power in terms of unions, and then lowering costs, such things as child care assistance or universal preschool. Things like that that will lower the costs on the cost side of the equation. And expanding those kinds of programs, healthcare, covering healthcare costs, those kinds of things make a big difference because it doesn't matter whether your income goes up or your costs go down, but either way that gets you, you know, there. And if you do some of both, that's important.
Well, we're going to be looking at that in the rest of the show, but thank you so much for your perspective, Diana Pierce.
Thank you.
Diana Pierce is director of the Center for Women's Welfare and Social Work professor at the University of Washington. George, Rob, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.